Hi, I'm Greg Schaefer, and welcome to the Virtual CISO Moment. Brian Smith joins us today. He is the founder and CTO of Spiderbat ensures security and resilience across your software development life cycle in Linux. I'm tripping over my tongue today. I'm going to let you talk about Spiderbat in just a bit. But anyway, Brian, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We'd love to hear about your cyber technology journey, how and why you got started in it. I know you're one of the rare ones that actually I've talked to so far that actually has gone through to the higher degree. You have a PhD, I believe, in computer science. So talk about your path. What led you to there and then to founding not only Spiderbat, but a couple of other companies?
Yeah, it was... I think most people have a windy path. You sort of start down one direction and then the universe just takes you which way it wants to. It's usually a good idea to listen. So I kind of started off wanting to be a physicist and went and got a bachelor's in physics at Berkeley. And then but I was always doing computer science. So I ended up getting a job in the computer science department there as a programmer, and then getting pulled into grad school in computer science and getting a PhD there. But it had nothing to do with cybersecurity. It was building the first software video decoders back in the late 80s. So both that built the first MPEG-1 video decoder. And then I went and that worked out well. And I was a professor of computer science at Cornell for 5 years. And fell in love with this woman and married her, but there was a two-body problem. She wanted to be a professor too. So we ended up in Texas. And while here, I was trying to commercialize some of the technology I'd been doing. And I called up a friend to see if he could join me in forming the startup company. And he dragged me into a different startup company. And that startup company eventually became Tipping Point, which was a cybersecurity company. And it built back in around 2000, it built these intrusion prevention systems, which were network devices.
I remember Tipping Point way back in the day, because I grew up in the networking field. And that did trigger something in me. But I'm like, it wasn't until you started to talk about it. I'm like, no, it's the same company. That's right. I don't think I ever used the product. I'm sorry. I worked for organizations that had very low budgets, I guess. I don't know.
But I'm offended.
I'll go back in time and I'll change it. So
no, so Tipping Point was kind of this bump in the wire technology. Conceptually, you cut a wire and plug both ends in and it cleans out the traffic. It was the first kind of along those lines of intrusion prevention. And that went well, and went to three. Got bought by 3Com, and I spent 4 years and four CEOs at 3Com, where they were trying to figure it out, and eventually left and started Qlik Security. And Qlik was trying to address all the problems that we learned from talking to cybersecurity people at Tipping Point, and trying to address that. And the way to think about that is around 2009. That was an XDR. Essentially. Learned a lot about what works and what doesn't work and why SIMs are the way they are and why they don't, you know, why, what their limitations are. And that company we sold to Alert Logic, and then stayed there for another 2.5 years and went off and just couldn't keep myself away. And so my business partner, Mark, and I formed Spiderbat. And this is the third one. So that's kind of how I got there. But it, like I said, it was just kind of windy journey through physics and video processing. And ultimately, I just like to build things. So
well, and I always encourage folks, it's just that if someone is 20 years old, they're like, well, I don't know what I want to do with my life. It's like, that's okay. I'm 56. I'm not quite sure either. But no, you're right. It is a winding road. I started out actually in aerospace engineering. And so my programming back then, you probably programmed in a lot of languages. The main language we programmed in as engineers back then was Fortran 77. Yep. I couldn't program in Fortran 77 right now to save my life, probably, but it does bring back some memories. Yeah. Well, you've seen a lot along the way, not in some ways, not necessarily directly dealing with businesses, but then again, also being part of startups and being and building businesses and then selling them. So I think you have a rather unique perspective in that sense. I always like to get opinions on what people feel are the greatest threats to small and mid-sized businesses today from a cybersecurity perspective. What comes to mind when I ask that?
Well, you know, with my background, a lot of the people we've been selling to, we have this mix of small businesses to very large businesses. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of two classes in there. One is the group of people that are using kind of off the shelf type technologies, using kind of Windows and things like that, and those that are building their own technologies. The smallest business we have is two guys. So, you know, it's,
yeah,
and a dog, I think. And you know, what we found is that a lot of businesses are going into using sorry, work from home challenges.
No worries.
So a lot of businesses we're working with are building, you know, have a cloud presence or building a cloud presence. Mm-hmm. And if you're building a cloud presence, chances are you're working in something like, you may be building custom software. And custom software has a whole different set of problems and challenges from off-the-shelf software. Because think about how you secure like Windows or something like that. You'll go out, a typical set of things you might do is go buy antivirus type technologies, EDRs and things like that. Or you might go get CrowdStrike. And the way those businesses work is kind of the way that Tipping Point, which is there's a research group out there that studies the software that's deployed out there and its vulnerabilities, figures out how to detect and block attacks against those vulnerabilities. So a vulnerability, you know, is just a flaw in software that can be exploited. Mm-hmm. So it figures out how to block that stuff. But if you're building your own stuff, who's researching your vulnerabilities in your custom software? There is no one doing that. And so those kind of approaches don't really work in that environment. That gets more complicated in cloud environments because a lot of times, if you're deploying something like Kubernetes, and we see actually a fairly decent number of small businesses using that. If you have like two or three shops and you want to have like on-site software to maybe to do inventory or something like that, companies are using stacks of two little bricks, you know, those little mini PCs, deploying a Kubernetes cluster on that, just using it as a way to get software out there because it's a little easier. Mm-hmm. So, those types of things are these incredibly dynamic environments where things come and go, containers come and go, nodes come and go. And by the time you detect detecting attacks is really hard. And so if you try to detect an attack, then who's going to run it to ground? And by the time they run it to ground, the thing's already changed and gone. And so the environment is just very, very different than the one we have right now. And so that's that's a lot of the challenges that we're trying to solve is how to secure these new environments rather than the older ones.
Well, getting back to the idea as far as like building your own software, and I think that that's a good example to start leaping off of. I'm thinking in my mind, you have a small startup, a handful of people, half dozen maybe. That's probably pretty typical for these sorts of like SaaS and other niche type software startups. They're, from my experience, because I have a couple that I've worked in the virtual CISO world that are that small, they're very, very resistant to they understand security is important, but they're resistant to stopping the flow of development. So anything that would introduce friction, for example, to the whole process. And when you're developing software, I'm not a software developer, but it's my understanding that there are certain practices that you need to adhere to, and that you should ideally have code reviews done both internally and externally. Totally. Are those things that you think that startups in particular who are writing software in-house, are they having to neglect that in order to be competitive to get to build to market? or can they be working better in that environment, but they just don't have the tools for it?
Well, I think it's the challenge almost everyone has in these environments is, you know, essentially managing your resources. Because, can we pause for just a second?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
All right, we're back. So we were talking about software development, small companies, the tendency to want to skip over that. So go ahead with what you were saying.
Well, I mean, when you're a small company and your number one thing is getting product out to market, getting, you know, and mm-hmm. meeting your customer needs and being successful as a company.
And that's the most important thing to your investors, by the way, too.
And that's the most important thing to everyone, to your customers, mm-hmm. to your investors, to just, you know, survival as a small company mm-hmm. is doing that. So software developers like to develop software. That, you know, securing software is kind of sort of a chore that needs to be done, but it's like,
yeah, I mean, it's a speed bump, really. It's just like, no, yeah. I want this thing to work. It, you know, me coming up in networking, it's like, I when I realized that more of my career about like round 2003 or something like that, it became more about stopping people from talking to each other than getting people to talk to each other. That was almost like a something in me died. But the same thing here, they're just wanting to develop to get the product that actually works, but having to understand that actually work also means resilience in some way, shape or form.
Exactly. Well, it's you have to then identify, you know, the most efficient way is to identify the risks that you're actually facing mm-hmm. and then deal with those risks, because, you know, there's a little bit of this philosophical group from people that haven't tried to build security where it's like, you should just ship code with no bugs and you should patch absolutely every vulnerability that's ever been announced anywhere. And, you know, the problem with that is, I mean, anyone who's dealt with this, you'll get this raft of vulnerabilities in there and most of them don't apply to you. And so mm-hmm. you can either try to figure out how to fix everyone, and some of them don't have fixes. And, or you can try to figure out what's actually being used and try to fix those, or try to figure out how to deal with attacks and secure those. So we have a kind of a different approach that we've been using, but in general, I think it's a matter of trying to focus on how, it's like everything, how to best spend your time. Because if you just try to absolutely fix everything everywhere, you're not going to ship product.
Well, they're under the gun because, again, getting back to the investors, it's they're not giving you money to have fun making cool stuff. They're giving you money to have fun making cool stuff that will then make a return on their investment. And so the clock is ticking. And I'm sure that there's a lot of pressure there, but you got me to think about something, and you would probably know the answer to this, but outside of like simple code, like, you know, what do we all... At least when I was a kid, the first program I wrote was 10, print hello, 20, go to 10, you know, in BASIC. But has there really ever been meaningful code ever written that wasn't vulnerable in some way, shape, or form down the road?
Well, let me ask you, has there ever been meaningful code ever written that didn't have any bugs ever?
Well, that's what I mean. It's just like
that's the same question.
It's almost the same question there. And the answer to both would be no. Yeah. So it's like... Yeah. You would almost have to assume as a developer, I caught a little bit of like, I don't want to necessarily say that it was ego, but it's almost like a pride. It's like, I can develop code and I'm so good at it that there will never be any bugs in here. I'm sure they're not really thinking that, but they're probably diminishing the value. It's like, well, no, if some coder out of college just started doing it, that'd be one thing, but you don't need to check me. I know what I'm doing. Is that an issue?
I think it's, you know, the way I think about it is, you know, vulnerabilities are just bugs in software that can be exploited, you know, that have some security implication.
Right.
And so, you know, you can't ship code with the idea that you have no bugs ever and that you're going to ship code that is completely bug free of known and unknown bugs, because that's what you have. So what do? Well, you prioritize from development standpoint, you always prioritize, you know, fixing the important bugs, the customer visible bugs, that those things, not every little thing that ever shows up, including the stuff that's entirely not even visible on the outside. Vulnerabilities are the same way. You focus on the things that matter, you definitely fix those because they could be attacked. And then it doesn't mean that you never monitor your software once it's shipping. You kind of are on the lookout for problems and bugs and things going wrong. And that's what you need to do with the same thing from the software side. You have to have something in there that's watching it at runtime. It's not just enough to say, I patched all my vulnerabilities. We used to call that patch and pray.
Right.
I'll fix all my bugs and then pray that nothing happens. And you would never do that from an operational standpoint in anything else in your life. Why do you do it this way?
So they have to build into the whole development process the idea that they're going to be needing to do quick fixes, hot fixes, or full blown patches at some point in time. They're going to be needing to monitor for that.
That's part of it, monitoring for kind of vulnerabilities being announced and stuff like that. But it's more like monitoring, is my software going sideways? So suppose you had a bug in your software that you didn't know about, that no one knew about, and it got attacked, and they decided to start using your platform as a basis for attacking other people, or they started trying to rip off your database or do any number of other things. Mm-hmm. The typical pattern of what will happen is they'll get in and then they'll try to get some foothold of their own software in there so that they have their tooling and they can start working on it. And there's two ways to do that. They can upload their own software, or they can do what's called living off the land, which is look around and see what tools are built into the operating system or the environment they're in and start using that. So they might fire up MySQL if you're using a SQL database, and then select star from credit cards. Mm-hmm. and just copy it, right? Mm-hmm. If you were watching that at real time, you wouldn't need to know that there's a bug or a vulnerability, or you wouldn't care. It's like, holy smoke, someone's stealing or robbing us blind, right? That's the thing you need to know at that time. So what's watching that? If you think about what EDRs did and or AV or any of the detect and block type things, they had known bad things that they were looking for. Someone was trying to install malware. They'd see the malware is trying to fire up and they just shoot it in the head automatically. And you didn't have to be there. What's the equivalent of that for your custom software, for the software you built that's maybe running on a cloud server? And that's I think the answer to that is that the developer knows how that software is supposed to behave. So if they can describe that to the system that's watching and say, look, these are the guardrails that it should do. It should only talk to these other servers. These are the programs that should run that's starting from, you know, wherever I'm running. These are my binaries that I wrote. Anything else that happens, shoot it in the head.
So kind of like a predetermined set of guidelines. It's like, if it doesn't meet these things, even though it could run, it's just like, it's not running. Maybe I don't know, really bad analogy is just like, you can't take your car out on a dirt road. Well, if the road is dirt, then don't drive your car. I mean, the car could drive on the dirt road. It's just, you don't want to do that for whatever
reason. Something like that. It's, you know, there's always this tension of what's called whitelisting and blacklisting, default allow, default deny. So the default allow thing is everything's allowed unless it's on the bad list, and then you kill it. And that's what the kind of one family of technologies. And that works for things where everyone's using the same stuff, because you can have researchers figure out what the bad stuff is.
Right.
The default deny means everything's denied unless it's allowed. And that's really good for like servers and things where it's pretty fixed function what it's doing, and you know what that function is. And then the problem just becomes, how do you figure out what those rules are, and how do you maintain it, and what do you do when they break and stuff like that? And that's kind of what we've been working on. But so how it applies to that world.
How does SpiderBet float fit into all of this?
So we kind of took that idea that I'm describing and ran with it. And the first thing you have to do is when you want to build this, this is the guardrails of what this thing does, is identify what this thing does, right? And so what we do is we have monitoring software that you install just on there, and it kind of is a recorder. It's almost like exactly what we're doing here. And it records every process it runs, every file that's touched, every network connection, all this data. And then what I can do is I can look at your little program. Typically it's in these environments, it's in a container, like a Docker container or something like that, Docker image, and look at what's running at runtime. how it's running and what the things it's talking to. And we build profiles from example runs of that. And from those, we have software that just merges that all together and say, okay, this looks like how this thing behaves. What do you think? And the developer or the security guy can edit in like 2 or 3 minutes and say, this is what it should be. It's not just talking to this server, it's anyone in this range, maybe IP range is okay. And then you put it out there and you let it run. And at that point, it's protecting you. If something goes outside that range, you can turn it to alert or block. And if you develop and put out a new piece of code with a new feature in it, it says, hey, I saw this deviation. Do you want to merge it? You just click yes, and you keep on going. And this way, you begin to lock down these services, because the difference is the servers are kind of fixed function. You put them out there. They do what they're supposed to do, run the software they're supposed to run, and that's pretty much what they do. Right. It's not like your phone or laptop where people are installing new software or doing all there are these users that are doing all sorts of different things on there. It's more kind of a fixed function thing. And so we can take advantage of that. So that's what Spiderbed has then, is this kind of recording software that supports this life cycle of figure out what the profile is, define the profile and start protecting your stuff.
So, and I always like to distill things down to like simple concepts, because I'm a simple concept kind of guy. So if my usual Monday routine is I go to the gym, then I come into work, I have a bowl of cereal, and then at lunchtime I go to the microwave at 12:45, I heat up a dinner in a plastic tray, and then at 3:45 I leave. And that's typically what I do every single day, let's just say. If for whatever reason, I'm not showing up to do my lunch on Monday, and cooking it at 12:45. That's something outside of the norm. That might be something I would trigger a monitoring. Like somebody in the office here might say, "Hey, you know, I haven't seen Greg around this morning. I wonder if he's sick. Maybe we should go check on him." So that's sort of like a very, very, very high level analogy.
You're a human being. You're Greg, so you might have normal variations. Computer software just doesn't have those type of variations.
Well, not yet, until the AI bot army starts to take over the universe. But
those are the people attacking, going to be attacking us.
That's true. We don't have to worry about that. That's fascinating. So what's your typical customer motif? Example of a typical customer for Spiderbed?
Well, you know, it is. You know, we're a startup company, like everyone, although we're getting out of the startup phase, honestly. We have enough customers that it's hard to call ourselves a startup anymore. But anytime you start a company, you have to kind of focus on kind of a target market, kind of the customers that you're going to make really happy. And we've been focusing on people that are running cloud on Linux, so like AWS or anything like that, right, or people running Kubernetes. And so that's Google Cloud, Azure Cloud.
And why did you focus on those two most popular ones out there?
That's where a lot of the two reasons. One is, you know, if you look at there's sort of the Windows market, but then there was this Linux market over here that everyone was building all their stuff on, and virtually none of the traditional vendors were doing anything good in there. So it was sort of a market ripe for disruption. So we were able to kind of go and do that. And then the other problem is it had all this emerging tech in terms of, kind of the way cloud attacks work and the way Kubernetes attacks kind of actually work. And so we were able to, kind of focus on those, and it was a little less incumbency there. There weren't a lot of people doing much in that space, because it was changing very, very fast. And it was kind of a new set of attacks and so on.
I can only imagine that going through the startup phase, and you've done it a few times now over a couple of decades, that there's a lot of stress involved with trying to keep things going. And you've obviously survived it quite well over the years. You must have had some sort of methodology or practice to be able to remove yourself from the stress. What are one or a couple of things you do to get away from the stresses associated with that?
There's kind of two classes of those things that I think about. One is I've been playing a lot of tennis I have two boys. They're grown now. They're not boys anymore. But my younger one was involved in a lot of tennis. I sort of started playing with him when he was a kid, and then quickly he got much better than anything I ever did. And so I started coming back into it. And now we're at the point where actually we can play doubles together in tournaments and stuff like that.
Oh, that's neat.
So it's fun. It's kind of been a fun thing being able to play play that with my son and, you know, play doubles tournaments and things like that. So that's part of it. And then the other incredibly nerdy thing I do is, remember I said I got a bachelor's in physics when I was.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, growing up as a kid, I grew up on like Star Trek, and, you know, like so many of us. And I always wanted to figure out how to build those things. And so I've been studying physics my whole life. The reason I got out of it is because I like knowing physics a lot more than I like doing physics.
Right.
But especially now that, you know, kind of the internet and YouTube and, you know, kind of all these things are out there, I can watch lectures by Leonard Susskind, you know, watching it colloquium, which is, he's a physicist out of Stanford that does some really wonderful stuff. And all these things that I would have had to been at university to experience, I can sort of follow those ideas. And so I spend a lot of time just still trying to understand how quantum physics works and, you know, being able to do quantum physics.
I think that's great. You know, it's, and on a much lower level, I have a fascination with that. I'm one of those that actually never sold back any of their textbooks in college. And I have all that downstairs and in the basement and ready to look at again. And one of these days I want to reteach myself calculus. But when you brought up physics, it triggered a latent memory in my mind. Physics taught me a very important career lesson that has almost nothing to do with physics. So I guess maybe like freshman year, you're doing calculus, and I just wasn't getting it. It was more like, okay, I guess I can figure out how to do derivatives, but why? Who cares? And then when you get to, and I hope I get this right because it's been many years, but then when you get to physics and you realize that velocity, I believe, is the derivative of your location and acceleration is the derivative of velocity, it's like, I guess with respect to time, I hope I'm saying that right. I'm accessing stuff from like 40 years ago. But that's
pretty impressive, actually.
but those were like, it was suddenly like that was applied knowledge. It's like, oh, now I get it. And so the reason why that's important today is that I a lot of times people in cybersecurity in particular, they're very upset about the fact that they're sending out all these resumes, not getting a response. Everybody looks the same. They all have like, you know, 7.2 certs and are between like 1% and 4% on Try Hack Me and all that. And they all look exactly the same. But what differentiates you, whatever I look for whenever I interview a candidate, is that can you apply the knowledge? And that was the most important thing I learned. So thank you for triggering that. I'm going to have to go find my calculus books now. I don't know. I got, I tell you though, it's like I got as far to finite element. Oh, there you go. Okay. I actually ended up the furthest, most advanced course I took in mathematics was finite elements. The only reason why I took it is not because I liked it, but because I really liked the instructor. So, So what are your future plans? Are you going to build a transporter or something? Talking about Star Trek?
You know, it's the neat thing about being alive right now is I was reading about this back in, you know, just two generations back, the life expectancy was like 50. Mm-hmm. And now it's, you know, 80. And so we've got 3 decades. And so in some ways we're like halfway through. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of things, and you could have kind of 2 or 3 careers. And so I've kind of thought about what other careers I'd like to do, because part of me is I'm still just fascinated by trying to solve this cybersecurity problem, but also, you know, building rocket ships is interesting. And I found I'm actually really good at education, at teaching and stuff, which was kind of when I was at Cornell, and I love it and I'm naturally gravitated towards it. So I might go back into education and try to disrupt that area. Or there's some really interesting things that are becoming possible to do in the space industry right now that I'm exploring. There's some things that I'm fascinated there. There's these things called plasma drives that they're not mm-hmm. what you plasma magnet drives. If you look it up, but if they worked, there's theoretically could take us to, you know, Jupiter in 5 days. So,
and they're going to find a monolith out there orbiting. And okay, I'm now getting into 2001 stuff.
So, you know, just things like that. I don't 100% know exactly what I'm going to do. But I have a lot of passions. And so it's usually the universe tells you which way to go if you're willing to listen.
Absolutely. I'm sort of like there myself, you know, somewhere in my 50s. And really, this is one of the things that I pivoted to doing the podcast. I love doing this stuff just to kind of help people and help educate and talk to very interesting people like you. And I learn a lot and I trigger latent memories that I thought that I had buried forever. So
maybe tried to bury.
I'm going to have to go and like integrate something. Well, listen, Brian, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you've got a very busy schedule today, so very much appreciate you coming down and chatting with us.
Thanks, Greg. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
And everybody, stay secure.